chapter 24, verses 13 through 35. There it is. That very day, two of them were going to a village named Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And they were talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing together, Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What is this conversation that you are holding with each other as you walk?" And they stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, named Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened here in these days?" And he said to them, "What things?" And they said to him, "Concerning Jesus of Nazareth, a man who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things happened. Moreover, some women of our company amazed us. They were at the tomb early in the morning, and when they did not find his body, they came back saying that they had even seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but him they did not see. And he said to them, 'O foolish ones, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory?' And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself." So they drew near to the village to which they were going. He acted as if he were going to farther, and they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, for it is toward evening, and the day is now far spent." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at table with them, he took the bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them. And their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, "Did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures?" And they rose that same hour and returned to Jerusalem. And they found the 11 and those who were with them gathered together, saying, "The Lord has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated.
I will begin our time with a story, but before that, a little audience participation, because we have some younger folks here in the room, and that tends to go over well. So here's just a pop quiz. Who has ever been to the state of Kansas? Okay, a handful of people. Who has ever been to the state of Colorado? Maybe a few more people. Now here's the clincher, right? Who has ever driven from Kansas to Colorado? Wow, a few people. Matt Burton in the back. Excellent. Wonderful. Well, I have had the opportunity to do that. And in February of 2007, a group of men from the church where I was serving, we got in some vans and we decided to drive west to a men's retreat in Colorado from Kansas, where we lived. There's one road to take, essentially, and it's Interstate 70. And Kansas, despite what people may say, Kansas actually does have some topographical changes. There are some hills. There's a wonderful area towards the center of the state called the Flint Hills. It's beautiful. But when you start getting past central Kansas into western Kansas, the rumors are true. It is pretty flat. And even western Colorado is pretty flat. So it's interesting to think, as we're driving on the same road, the same direction, the whole way, the horizon looks pretty flat. And then before too long, as you start to focus your eyes on the horizon, you begin to see something that looks a little bit like our first picture that you might see. You can kind of see something in the distance, and you say to yourself, "Those look like the Rocky Mountains." And sure enough, as you drive a little bit closer, it looks a little bit more like this next picture. And sure enough, you can begin to see the Rocky Mountains. But what's interesting is you realize they're actually there the whole time. But you just couldn't see them until you got closer to them. Now, I have another picture which shows when we arrived at this retreat, we took a wonderful hike. I actually took this picture while on our hike, and that's Pike's Peak, which you see in the distance, one of the more famous mountains. I think it's a 14,000-foot mountain in the Rocky Mountains. And what I want to show you is that they were there the whole time. But when you're far away, you can't see them until you get closer. And just to prove that I was there, the final picture actually shows me. I'm up on this rock. That's me, that dark figure. Someone took the picture of me. That's Pike's Peak in the distance. It was amazing, though, because when I spent personal time in that area, I realized just how high the heights of the Rockies were and just how deep the depths of the valleys were and just how vast they were. But it wasn't until I spent time there that I could see all that they entailed. I'm reminded of this story when I think about Easter, because the truth is, our vision sometimes needs to be corrected. Sometimes our vision is impaired and we are unable to see the risen Jesus Christ until we get closer to him and spend time with him, both physically and spiritually. Our vision needs to be corrected. I'm reminded of one of my favorite lines from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. If you've read that, Holmes and Watson are having this exchange, and Holmes says to Watson, "Watson, you see, but you do not observe," which has become one of my wife's famous lines for me. She's like, "You see, but you do not observe." It's amazing how I miss the obvious that's right in front of me. And I do believe, spiritually speaking, this is true of us. And Easter shows us that our vision needs to be adjusted with the eyes of faith to see the risen Christ. Jesus, by a gift of his grace, gives us this vision when we need it most. So that's where we are this morning on this Easter Sunday. We conclude our Explore the Table series with our passage here from Luke chapter 24. And the message this morning is at a table with Jesus. What we'll see as we look at this passage is that it is an amazing account from history, which shows something that's very important for us to learn on this Easter Sunday. We will examine the final table manner of Jesus, and we will understand that we have hope today to trust him by faith because of the resurrection of Christ. We will see a lot of themes of sight and recognition as Luke has read this passage to us already. In fact, I like to argue that 7 times in this passage we see a reference to sight or seeing and so forth. Overall, this passage is full of irony, but it's an amazing passage that gives us an amazing message for this morning. So to orient us, I'll just give us a brief structure of what Luke 24, 13 through 35 looks like. And this is great because it reads sort of like 4 acts of a play or 4 scenes of a movie. I think this would actually make a fascinating movie. But the first scene or the first act is the introduction. Next is the conversation. Next is the revelation. And then finally, the celebration. And what I'll do is I'll just walk us through each of those sections in our passage, and we'll take a little bit of a deeper dive into them and then pull some application from this that applies to us today. Just as by way of introduction, which would be the first 3 or 4 verses, verses 13 through 16 of this passage, I need to say some context. We learned about the context at the start of our service at the very beginning of Luke chapter 24. It's Easter Sunday. Some people have gone to the tomb of Jesus. Some women went in order to give some final preparation for his body. And lo and behold, the stone's rolled away, the tomb is empty, they can't find his body. And you can imagine what they must have been thinking. Well, someone took it. Where did it go? The last thing that they were thinking was, I bet Jesus was raised from the dead and walked right out of that tomb. That was the last thing that they were thinking, as will be evident as we look at our passage today. So these women see a vision of an angel that says, why are you looking for the dead among the living? He's alive. It blows their minds. They can't adjust to that. They go back and they tell the other disciples and the group of people gathering, we've seen these angels. They say he's alive. We didn't see his body. And the text says that they viewed the women's report as idle talk. They almost thought it was nonsensical. So this is their parameter. This is their perspective. Peter himself jumps up. As you know, Peter always wanted to see things for himself. He runs, he looks in the tomb, He can't see the body, and it says he walks away, and he marveling at what he had just seen, trying to make sense of it all. That's where we have the action that picks up here. They were in disbelief. As we see these two disciples, we'll find that indeed they were having a hard time understanding the reality of the resurrected Christ on that first Easter. So that's the introduction. Interestingly, in the ESV, I really do enjoy and love this translation of the Bible, but I do have one gripe in our passage today. The ESV does not actually include one of the first and I think most important words of the language in the Greek that's here in the text. And it's a word that is translated, behold. It could also mean look. So there's your first reference to sight. Literally, the translation says, and behold that very day. That is the resurrection day. What Luke wants you to do is to know that there is a connection to what's just been talked about and what he's just written and this scene that we find ourselves in now. Behold, look, there were two of them who were going to a village named Emmaus. Emmaus, possibly about 7 miles from Jerusalem. If that's the case, it would have taken about an hour and 45 minutes to walk there. These disciples were probably on their way from Jerusalem, and that's important to note, they are moving away from Jerusalem after the Passover feast on that Sunday morning. And they're confused. The text tells us that they are talking with each other about all these things that had happened. They're talking about what had just happened to their teacher, to their rabbi, to this man that they had hoped would be the Redeemer of Israel. And they're trying to make sense of it. Wait, the women said his tomb was empty and his body wasn't there? What does this mean? In fact, even says in verse 15, they were talking and discussing. It actually means they were having a pretty passionate dialogue, maybe even a debate, maybe even an argument as they moved away from Jerusalem to Emmaus. Interestingly, they encounter, and they, by the way, they might have been surrounded by other pilgrims moving from Jerusalem to their hometowns along the way. And then one of these supposed pilgrims walks up to them. Come to find out, we have the behind-the-scenes view, like if you were directing a movie, that this is Jesus himself. This is profound. But yet it says their eyes were kept from recognizing him. The word for eyes there, ophthalmos, where we get our word ophthalmology, means that physically they could not see him, but it spoke to a deeper spiritual condition of their hearts as well. They could not recognize him personally. And we might wonder why that is. A scholar and author, Daryl Bach, writes, "There would come a time when the disciples would clearly see, but in their current uncertainty, God still had things to teach them. They didn't see because they didn't believe that Jesus could actually be raised from the dead. And the irony of ironies, this would be one of their final and most important lessons from their rabbi, and they wouldn't even know it until the end." So that then leads to the conversation, which happens from verses 17 through 27, where Jesus essentially walks up and says, "You know, what are you talking about? What is this conversation you're having with each other?" Of course, he knew. But it's amazing. The text says they stopped and they were sad. It literally means their faces were long. Their faces were sad. They were so overcome by their grief and their disbelief, they had to stop in their tracks. Ironically, they look at Jesus and they say, "Are you not the only visitor?" That word visitor means sort of someone who's staying for a short period of time. "Are you not the only visitor in Jerusalem who doesn't know about these things?" Well, absolutely he does. He went through them all. But they were still in disbelief. And they say, "What are you talking about? Of course, everyone knows about these things." Jesus says, "Tell me more." And they say, concerning Jesus of Nazareth, in verse 19, "a man who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and before all people." This connects Jesus to his role as a prophet. That was something that Luke did throughout his writings. In fact, we see a number of passages up on the screen where Luke connects Jesus to the prophetic work that he carried out in chapters 4, 9, 13, and even into his other work, the book of Acts, where he also talks about the prophet that Jesus was in chapters 3 and 7, connecting Jesus to Moses as the great prophet of the Old Testament, whose ministry would ultimately point to Jesus as the great prophet, priest, and king of the New Testament. And it's amazing to think that he was a prophet, but he was so much more. You hear that sometimes as you talk to people about Jesus and they say, yeah, I believe he could have been a prophet or a great teacher, but he was so much more. These disciples did not understand because their vision was partial. It was impaired. Another scholar, Joel B. Green, writes, what was lacking in their interpretation of Jesus' significance, however, is the understanding that as God's prophet, Jesus must fulfill the destiny of the prophets, rejection, suffering, and death. Thus, they thus misunderstood the prophetic pattern in the scriptures that Jesus fulfills. Their lack of vision was based off their lack of understanding, which was part of their lack of belief. So their expectations were not met, as we'll get to in just a moment. Therefore, they had hope, and that had turned into hopelessness. It led to dejection, disappointment, and disillusionment. And Jesus continues to listen as they talk about what they had hoped that this great prophet would do. We had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. We had hoped that he was, in other words, to be the great son of David who would once again sit on the throne in Israel and rid us of this oppressive Roman rule that continues to be our undoing each and every day as a nation. We had hoped that he would be the great political ruler and deliverer of our nation. And oh my, how Jesus would fulfill that, but would fulfill so much more than they even expected. And they go on to say, besides all this, this is the third day since these things had happened. Okay, if you're taking a cinematography class in college, like I did, I know my dad questions that decision, but I still did it. You're looking for clues that you know tell the story. They have just given us a big clue, the third day. This should recall to the reader very much and very clearly words that Jesus had already spoken in Luke chapter 9, verses 20 and 21. And he strictly charged them and commanded them to tell this to no one, saying, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. And folks, this would not be the first and only, this would be the first time, but not the only time that Jesus would clearly tell his disciples what was going to happen. But they weren't sure that they could believe it, even though they had been given all the information. They say that women came to our group and said they saw visions of an angel, but him they did not see. More language connecting sight and vision to this passage. It was almost like a news flash that came across their desktop or on their phone. What, his body's gone? His tomb's empty? I don't know how to make sense of this. Jesus offers them a rebuke, which might sound harsh, but it is appropriate. When he says in verse 25, O foolish ones and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Foolish, referring to their lack of understanding, slow of heart to believe, referring to their lack of faith. This is what led to their lack of vision and their lack of ability to see Jesus. And then he begins unfolding the Old Testament for them. He says, was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? This word Christ is a Greek word from a Hebrew word, Mashiach, which means God's anointed agent that would carry out his special kingdom work and usher in the new season of God's kingdom reality. And Jesus points out, even though you didn't think that it was necessary for this Christ to suffer, the scriptures clearly say that he needed to. And if you refer back to passages like Isaiah 53, Psalm 118, you see that indeed the anointed one would suffer. And to go from suffering into glory refers to the reality that the resurrected Christ is also the ruling Christ, ruling over God's kingdom. This shows that he has all authority because of the victorious resurrection from the grave. Jesus continues to say that the entire Old Testament, he says in verse 27, beginning with Moses, which would be the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, and moving through the prophets, he interpreted them in all the scriptures, including the Psalms and Proverbs and so forth, all of these things concerning himself. Again, the final lesson from their rabbi, and they didn't know it the whole time that he was right there. But Luke definitely wanted to show us that Jesus fulfilled the entirety of the Old Testament. And this is a fascinating point to me, because wouldn't it have been easy for Jesus to say, "Excuse me, gentlemen, look at my wrists, look at my side, look at my feet." But for some reason, I think I know why, he didn't show scars, he showed the scripture, which is a fascinating and powerful point for us to remember even today. Well, we get to the third act of our play, and this is really the climactic moment of the story, the revelation, verses 28 through 32. Again, the pivotal scene in the movie takes place here. Jesus appears to be going on past Emmaus, and maybe for reasons because of safety, if it was in the evening, the roads were not safe to travel at night because you could have gotten attacked and robbed. But maybe because of how intriguing his encounter with these men had been, they say, no, please, stay with us. The word there is the same one that was used of Zacchaeus when Jesus said, "It is necessary that I stay with you, abide in with you." They say, "Please stay with us." So Jesus goes in to stay and remain with them. And then we find one of the final, not the last one, but one of the final table scenes in the Gospel of Luke, where Jesus sits down. Their eyes are still closed to his reality. But he sits down, and Jesus, interestingly, plays host at this meal where he is the guest. Clearly, these men were intrigued and saw that he had something to offer, even though they did not fully understand yet. Jesus, in powerful language from Luke here, we read, takes the bread, blesses it, breaks it, and gives it to them. Now, before I share what happens next, which is powerful, these words should recall to mind for the reader of Luke two previous passages, one from Luke 9:16, the other from Luke 22:19. Luke 9:16, this is the feeding of the 5,000, where we read, "And taking the loaves and the two fish, he looked up to heaven and blessed, said a blessing over them, and then he broke the loaves and he gave it to the disciples to set before the crowd." Do you see that? Take, bless, break, give. We're also reminded of Jesus' words at the Last Supper in Luke 22:19. It's a little bit different, but similar in form. He took the bread, and when he had given thanks, there's kind of the replacement for blessing, he broke it and he gave it to them saying, "This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." The reader would be drawn to that formula of the taking, the blessing, the breaking, and the giving. And maybe that was what triggered these men finally to see and understand who was in their midst. But the text says, their eyes were opened in verse 31, and they recognized him. They saw him. They knew him personally. There's another reference to sight. It's a passive verb, which means someone had to open their eyes for them, and that someone was the Lord God himself. And what's amazing is, as soon as they saw him, they didn't. He was there, they saw him, and then he vanished. The word here, aphantos, is where we get our word for phantom. It means, literally, he became invisible to them. We might think, well, that's kind of cruel. But the truth is, once they saw him, they didn't need to see him anymore, because his resurrected reality had become real to them, and they finally understood. They no longer needed to see him, because in an instant, their hopelessness went to hope, and they realized who was in their presence. And what's fascinating to me is that it was intimate time at the table with Jesus that led for this occurrence to take place. So they have this immediate debrief. It's like after you have a meeting and you're really wondering what happened in that meeting, they talk to each other and said, really, what was going on? And they start to ask themselves questions, recalling. They say, did not our hearts burn within us when he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures? Now, friends, that word for opened there is the same word that's used for the opening of the eyes, which is a powerful connection. Again, Joel B. Green writes, what has happened with Jesus can be understood only in light of the scriptures. Yet the scriptures themselves can be understood only in light of what has happened to Jesus. Which leads to our fourth and final act of the story, the conclusion of the movie, which is actually part one, because part two of the movie would be, the sequel will be made in the book of Acts as this same group of people continues to proclaim this wonderful story. But the disciples return to Jerusalem. So now they're moving back to Jerusalem. The text indicates they did so immediately. They may have, or they may have waited until the morning when it was safer. Either way, when they first had the opportunity at that hour, they moved back towards Jerusalem very differently than when they left, right? They had hope because they had seen Jesus, but they were not the only ones. Because they arrive in the room with these apostles and other disciples, and they're prepared to tell them, guess what happened to us? And yet they hear a report that the disciples and apostles share. As they say, the Lord has risen indeed. Just so you know, sometimes we have this phrase that we'll say in church on Easter Sunday. We'll say, he is risen. And then people will typically say, he is risen indeed. That's where we get that phrase. And the word indeed actually comes in an emphatic position in the sentence in the Greek language to say, indeed he has risen and he has appeared to Simon, who is Peter, one of the leading apostles, the very same apostle who had denied Jesus, had now seen Jesus in an account that we don't read about here. But it confirmed everything. It confirmed what the women had reported. It confirmed what the disciples in Emmaus had seen. It confirmed what Peter had seen. Jesus was alive. What it also showed is that Jesus proved he is present with his disciples wherever they might be. A final quotation from Darrell Bock. Failure becomes fulfillment. Remorse is reversed in resurrection. Absence is presence. The curveball has not been thrown to humankind, but to death, sin, and Satan. The Lord is risen. He lives in their midst. God's plan has not been thwarted. And folks, that's why I believe that the story of Easter is really the greatest story. It is the greatest story of reversal. It's the greatest story of redemption. And it's the greatest story because all other stories of redemption are based off of it. Now, I couldn't resist. I thought, should I share this? Should I not? I couldn't resist. The University of Virginia men's basketball team. If you look here at the cover of Sports Illustrated's special digital copy, you see Kyle Guy, their shooting guard, and the title says, Redeemed! This is why we love all stories of redemption. You can't necessarily read it there, but what it says in those kind of subtitles is ultimate depths, unprecedented heights. In 2018, the University of Virginia became the first number one seed to lose to a 16 seed to the UMBC Retrievers. That hung over them the entire season, and yet this year in 2019, they're crowned national champions. And it's a great story. In fact, Tony Bennett, the coach of the Virginia Cavaliers, said afterwards, these guys are part of one of the greatest stories I've ever seen written. And these are his words. They'll tell it over and over again. The truth is, as great a story as that is, not just because I went to the UVA, because we all love those stories of absolute defeat to ultimate victory. You talk about ultimate depths. That was Christ on the cross. That was Christ in the tomb. Unprecedented heights. That was Christ raised on Easter Sunday. That's why Easter is the greatest story ever told. That will be told over and over again because it gives us hope. But what does it mean for us? Well, the story of Easter reveals to us Jesus' table manner of sight. His table manner of sight that he gives by his grace. Because Easter also reveals a problem and its solution. The problem is that our eyes are closed. Our eyes are closed. Spiritually speaking, we have difficulty, and in some cases, we are blind to the presence of the resurrected Christ right before you and right before me. Just to show you this, in Luke 18, verses 31 through 34, this is another time where Jesus clearly says, my friends, this will happen. And taking the 12, he said to them, see, we are going up to Jerusalem, and everything that is written about the Son of Man by the prophets will be accomplished, for he will be delivered over to the Gentiles and will be mocked and shamefully treated and spit upon. That's all pretty specific, right? And after flogging him, they will kill him, and on the third day he will rise. But they understood none of these things. This saying was hidden from them, and they did not grasp what was said. Folks, you see, failure to see and grasp was a problem for the disciples. It's a problem for us today. Because God has made himself and his ways abundantly clear, and he has made his presence known. But sometimes we lack the ability to see. Because we lack the ability to trust in him, we lack the ability to believe in him. And sometimes that's because we just don't want to. Sometimes that's because it's our choice. But many factors can lead to our eyes being closed. And you can read about these even in our passage today, but you can see the connection to our real lives. Disappointment, grief, fear, and anger, pain, confusion, pride, sin. Add to that financial problems, add to that relationship problems, add to that job or career problems, add to that health problems. Sometimes we are kept from seeing and our vision is impaired. But God desires through Easter to show us that he is there and to clear our vision so that we might see. But the truth is, we need a reality check before we can truly understand that. The reality check is that our sin and our sinfulness is an insurmountable problem. This passage shows us that Jesus, through his resurrection, has provided the ultimate solution to the ultimate problem, with a very interesting clue to an important text in the Old Testament. I'd like you to turn your attention to Genesis chapter 3, verses 6 through 7. What we find in this scene is that man and woman in the garden, everything's perfect, and yet Satan, represented by a serpent, has tempted them to doubt God's word. And he says, you should eat of this fruit, even though God said not to. Verses 6 and 7 of Genesis chapter 3. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. And here's the key phrase. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew they were naked. Well, that sounds a heck of a lot like Luke 24, verses 30 and 31. And he took the bread, blessed it, broke it, gave it to them, meaning they ate the bread, verse 31, and their eyes were opened, and they recognized him. I believe what Luke is trying to do here is he is trying to show how the resurrection of Christ is the ultimate solution to the ultimate problem of sin that was created when man and woman first disobeyed. You could look at that in Genesis 3 as the first meal of creation. You can look at Luke 24 as the first meal of the new creation. In the first meal was brought death and pain and suffering. In the second meal was brought life and hope through the pain and suffering of Christ. It's a clear and powerful connection. A scholar named Dane Ortlund, who wrote an article where I first saw this idea played out, writes, the first eye-opening with its attendant knowledge ushered humanity into a new moral universe of darkness, exile, sin, and death. The second eye-opening with its attendant knowledge pulled back the curtain to allow Jesus' distraught disciples to perceive that he himself had inaugurated the long-awaited new world of hope, resurrection, restoration, and the new creation. So what can we do to experience more fully this long-awaited new world of hope? What can we do to experience this great solution that God has provided through his Son to our great problem? The solution is really simple. Open the Word and come to the table. Open the Word, looking at the Scriptures. That is the truth of Christ. Come to the table. That is time with Christ, developing a relationship with him, which is how my spiritual journey really began. As I spent time opening the Word, God used it to open my eyes to see the living Word so that I might spend time with him. And that is what he desires. Again, Jesus could have shown scars, but he showed Scripture. I believe if one simple step that we take moving forward is that we open the Scriptures more and say, God, I don't fully understand this. I don't fully see, and this doesn't fully make sense, but I want to trust you, and I want to know you. He has made us himself known to us through his word. And I believe when we do that, we will begin to see the presence of Christ more fully. When he gives us that gift, that table manner of sight, and opens our eyes, we will be able to see with those open eyes his open arms on the cross, his open tomb on Easter Sunday, as well as his open table, which remains open to all who will call on him by faith today. Will you consider trusting in him today and seeing that he is with you? He always has been, and he always will be. As our band comes up with our closing song, In Christ Alone, I want you to know that this song proclaims very powerfully this great Easter message. There's a wonderful phrase and a wonderful chorus. There in the ground his body lay, light of the world by darkness slain. Then bursting forth in glorious day, up from the grave he rose again. That is the reality of Easter.